With the exception of an editorial postscript, which is probably by some later hand, the book of Ecclesiastes in the Bible is a pessimistic essay on the futility of human endeavor, in which it is assumed that history is a cyclical enterprise spinning around endlessly, never getting anywheres. There's no such thing as an unfolding of purpose. Progress is inconceivable. That which has been is that which shall be. That which has been done is that which shall be done. There is nothing new under the sun. Every generation is destined to repeat the mistakes, the inanities, the foolishness, and the evil of its predecessors. All things toil unto wickedness. And during 1968, I very often had this sense of historical familiarity. The Jewish people had been there before. We had been in Poland. We'd been in Poland for 1,000 years. Through every generation of that Polish-Jewish experience, we had seen political figures rise and appeal to the traditional anti-Semitism of the masses in order to further some project of their own or some faction of their own. We had seen the Jew be the scapegoat of political life. So it has always been, and so indeed it was. In Poland, the university youth was fractious and demanding reform, and so the Jew was responsible for their unruliness. In Poland, the artists and the writers were demanding a larger boundary to their freedom. And to the Communist Party apparatus, the Jew was responsible for these subversive influences. There arose in Poland a chief of police by the name of Mokhtar, who inflamed the passions of the mob by his speeches, who unleashed in the controlled press a deliberate anti-Semitic tirade, which lasted for months and is still in being today. And the Jew was again the victim of Polish political life. Jews were released from their positions in the universities. Jews were dismissed from their positions in lower ranks of the government. Jews were summarily fired from the newspapers and the radio and from other sensitive undertakings. There were 3 million Jews in Poland. There are less than 30,000 today. The numbers made it seem less than it might have been. But in the nation where the ovens of Auschwitz burned, where the graves of Babi Yar are unsignaled, where the Warsaw ghetto smoldered and is now unmarked, in that nation, the furies of the past were again let loose, and the howls of hate were again heard in the land. That which has been is that which shall be, and that which has been done is that which shall be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. In 1848, there were stirrings of freedom, and nationality rights, and hope in Central Europe. There was a pan-Slav movement in Prague. Louis Kossuth was alive and active in Eastern Central Europe, especially in Ruthenia and Hungary. There was great hope of reform, of an end to the iron fist which had been imposed upon Europe by the Congress of Vienna. And the Jews flocked to the banners of change. And in 1848, the pan-Slav revolt in Prague was put down. In 1849, the forces of Kossuth were defeated. You guessed it. It was the Jewish community that was the most severely fined. It was the Jewish members of the Reform League who were hunted down and imprisoned. The exile and self-exile of many from this part of the world began. Many of our grandparents and great-grandparents came to these shores in those days. And I cannot but believe that Prague in 1968 was not very much unlike Prague of 1948. There was the hope for larger freedom, the rights of small nations, and then that hope was dashed by a superior power, by interference from without. And the Jew was somehow both the victim and the symbol of the rebellion. It was a Jew, Edmund Goldstecker, who was called the arch-villain by the Russians. They attempted a show trial, but fortunately escaped to Great Britain. It was the Jew in Judaism who was responsible for revisionism, for subversion, for giving to the Europeans these new ideas about freedom and independence and intellectual responsibility. And it was the Jew who was the victim of the rebellion. The Jewish minister was the first to be summarily released. There's been a number of the Jews in the television and the radio world who have been let loose from their jobs. And another emigration, not unlike the emigration of 1848, has begun. 20% of the small Jewish community of Czechoslovakia, small community of 12,000, during these last 12 months, left their homeland. That which has been is that which shall be, and that which has been done is that which shall be done, and there is nothing new under the sun. But we said, America is different. In America, there is no endemic tradition of anti-Semitism with its inevitable side effects on the Jew of alienation and marginality. And we pointed to the facts, and there are accurate facts and observation, of the rapid movement of the Jew into almost every area of economic opportunity and political advantage. But is America really that different? During 1968, we watched, did we not, as a Jew was nominated to be the Chief Justice of our nation, and as that nomination was not accepted by the Senate, and though anti-Semitism was not the obvious issue or the verbalized issue, certainly it was an issue, some way, somehow, the American people were saying, "Thus far shalt thou go, but no further. You may come into our research plants, but not into the executive offices. You may come into many of our social undertakings, but not into our downtown clubs. You may come onto the benches of our land, but not be the chief justice, a symbol of justice in our land. Thus far shalt thou go, but no further. That which has been is that which shall be. That which has been done is that which shall be done." And during 1968, we learnt again that the Jew, as Jew, was expected to be a second-class citizen in certain respects. We were to accept more, to be more patient, to be more forgiving, to be less demanding of our rights than others. New York University appointed during 1968 a black man to be head of its Black Afro-American Center, dedicated in the name of Martin Luther King. And the man who was appointed by the New York University, it was discovered, had a record of excessive language, of having libeled groups, among them the Jewish group. He spoke particularly of teachers, but he spoke really of the entire group when he said in many of his writings that Jews were guilty of cultural genocide, of having poisoned the minds of Negro students in their schools. And when the Jewish groups in New York brought this to the attention of the white Christian administration of New York University, and to the largely white Christian board of New York University, the response was, "You're overexcited, you're thin-skinned, he really doesn't mean what he's saying, this is simply rhetoric, oratory. Be patient." And we were patient. And Mr. Hatchett, the man who was appointed, continued to make these statements. And they were part of the real reality of life in New York, which polarized the black and the Jewish communities during the New York school crisis. And other protestations were made to the board and to the administration of New York University, but we were told he has a right to say what he's saying. He's not saying what you think he's saying. And then one day, in a flight of oratory, this man Hatchett included among his catalog of what he called racist bastards that only Albert Shanker, the Jew, the president of the New York Teachers Union, but Mr. Nixon and Mr. Humphrey. And the next day, he was dismissed from his post in the NYU administration. There is not one law for the homeborn, for the stranger that is within thy midst. We must excuse and exculpate and explain, but when you attack with the same words the establishment, the non-Jewish political establishment, then you have transgressed the bounds, the bonds which America will not permit. That which has been is that which shall be. Through 1968, for the first time in many years, we saw anti-Semitism become legitimatized as an ideology, as political language in America. The beginnings were simply there, but they were to be observed and they were to be marked. And the beginnings, it must be said, were not in the traditional places of the deep South among the poor white trash of the Ku Klux Klan, but the beginnings now were among the black militants. Their poets, like Leroy Jones, were reading to their people about Jews, selling fried potatoes and people, little arty bastards talking arithmetic they sucked from the Arab's head. Suck you. The best is yet to come. Oh, how we beat you and killed you and tied you up and marked this specimen. Dangerous germ culture, and put you back in a cold box. Now, anti-Semitism was not yet quite legitimate, even in these extreme circles, but anti-Zionism was. There developed during 1968 an unexpected, unholy alliance between many of the black militant groups and the Arab League. Stokely Carmichael, the founder of SNCC, a Black Panther, went to the Organization of Arab Students in August of 1968 in Ann Arbor, and he told them that anyone who wants to join our cause must join your cause, and that the black American is prepared to die for the Arab cause against Israel. At some place, there was a disjunct in history. For 1,500 years, the Arabs have been the slave traders of Africa. 1,500 years, they have gone into dark Africa and brought out the black slave and sold him to their own people and across the face of Asia and of Europe. Arab literature is among the most racist in the world. But apparently, the legations and the embassies of the Arab states have money. And they're willing to dispense that money if militants, extremists in America, are willing to add to their catalog of challenges the cause of the Arab world. Whatever the explanation, among the black militants, there developed a new ideology, anti-Zionism. The Arab cause somehow had become part of the sacred cause of the black people and their domestic struggle in America. And it was spilling over to other areas. At the New Politics Convention in Chicago, where the white delegates had to accept sight unseen the platforms of the black caucus, there was included in those platforms a number of mendacious and vicious planks having to do with Israel and its legitimacy and its right to survive. And all those rootless young Jews who have made not the God of Israel, but the God of an ideology, their leader, were forced to swallow down this attack upon their traditional people, the families, except they wanted to follow in the footsteps of the party. We'd been there before. We'd been in Eastern Europe in the 1910s and 1920s when many young Jews had thought to follow, to be progressive, to be members of the Communist Party, and had found that they could not, that they had to be members of a Jewish Communist Party or a Jewish Social League, the Bund. And on the left, there's as much and as deep a tradition of anti-Jewish hate as there is on the right. We've been there before. We're saddened to see many young of our young people there again. But what worried us most during 1968 was the memory of Germany in the 1920s, when the conservative, feudal, Junker, Krupp upper classes joined themselves with a mob, made common cause, not overtly but covertly, passing money and political support because they had certain interests in common, keep down, keep out certain groups, and they had one interest in common, that they could scapegoat the Jew and blame the Jew for all the inflation and the other problems which beset Germany. Now, there is no parallel between Germany of 1920 and the United States of the 1960s, but there is this worry which many of us share. We see developing a manipulative political symbiosis between an establishment and between the black ideologists. The purpose, to keep some measure of peace in the community, to gain quickly political advantage in the community. And if the Jew happens to be caught in the middle, well, that's his problem. In 1968, some of the foundations in New York and some of the mayors of the community of New York, the boroughs of New York, seemed very much surprised that the Jewish teachers would stand up and say, you can't take my rights away and bargain them away to solve another problem. We have rights here too. That which has been is that which shall be. And that which has been done is that which shall be done, and as there is nothing new under the sun. But many of us said Israel is different. In Israel, the Jew is not marginal to a society, not suffering always the traditional anti-Semitism of the West. In Israel, the Jew is his own master. It's a whole man, and we're right. Of course, in Israel, the Jew is a whole man, but Israel is part of the world, and in the world, Israel is only one small state among many. And who of us here is prepared to say that the Soviet attitude towards Israel, that gleeful bearishness, that mulishness, that bullishness, which characterized Soviet policy during 1968, was altogether a calculated policy of appeasing the Arab world and was not in part a traditional hatred, the Jid, the Jew. 1968, Israel celebrated its 20th anniversary. It must have celebrated 20 years of freedom, 20 years of growth, 20 years in which Israel had emerged from a devastating war launched upon it by the Arab world, emerged as a modern technological state which had done miracles, human reconstruction, educational development, and the building of cities, and the building of a fine and orderly society. During 1968, Israel should by rights have enjoyed its accomplishment. But when Independence Day came, and Israel sought to do that which is most natural in any state, to have a patriotic pageant through its national capital, it somehow became an international incident. The world could not admit that Israel was at home and secure and was master of its own destiny. It had to challenge its veracity, its viability, by challenging this simple parade through the streets of Jerusalem. 1968 was a difficult year for Israel. was a year of nightly incursion, murder. The 20 years of Israel's existence, 2,500 Israelis have been murdered by the El Fatah, the Fedayeen, and all these other paramilitary groups. Imagine what America's reaction would be if in the last 20 years, a quarter of a million Americans had been murdered by terrorist groups from Canada. And that's the exact population proportion. Imagine how we would have reacted if we had had to accept a quarter of a million deaths. Would there not have been raids into Canada and reprisals and jet planes and worse? But Israel is told, you must be patient. You must turn the other cheek. You must forgive. The Arabs are an hysterical people. The Arabs are given to this kind of activity. That's their way. Learn to die with it. Between April of February 14th and March 18th of 1968, over 70 terrorist attacks are known to have been launched from Jordan. Those attacks cost Israel 6 lives, 25 men who were seriously wounded. On March 18th, a mine planted by some of these terrorists exploded 10 miles north of Eilat under a school bus. The 2 adults in the bus were killed, 28 children were seriously wounded. On March 19th, the Army of Israel launched a reprisal raid against Karameh, the main command post of the El Fatah in Jordan. On March 21st, the Security Council of the United Nations rebuked Israel for this raid. Now, there was no specific mention of the 70 raids and of the 6 lives and of the school children. There was no mention of the remonstrances by Israel to the United Nations daily about these attacks. No, there was only the rebuke of Israel for attempting to defend itself. I'm not very much impressed by the hot angels of the Security Council. 5 of the 15 nations in the Security Council refused to maintain diplomatic relations with the State of Israel. India, Pakistan, Algeria, Hungary, and the Soviet Union. One of these, Algeria, is actually at war, technically at war with Israel. The Soviet Union has, with some degree of glee, quite openly said that she will not permit any specific condemnation of any specific Arab state for any act of what we would call terrorism and what she chooses to call liberation against Israel. And somehow these great nation states meet and they exchange their pieties and they find reason to rebuke the small state, the aggrieved state. And they have yet to find occasion to put on the record the 1,000 incidents of murder and sabotage and bombing, gunfire, which occurred last year alone. Since the end of the war in 1967, Israel has lost as many casualties to terrorism as she did during the entire war. But none of this is on the record. The nation states choose to overlook it. And so it was in March, and so again in July with the attack on Salant, so again in December with the attack on the Beirut airport. Now, much nonsense has been written in our public press these last 10 days about neutral Lebanon, about the surprise of this innocent little state that she should suddenly be singled out by Israel for counterattack. Well, let's look at the record. Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine has its headquarters in Beirut. It has operated openly in Beirut for a number of years. It has no difficulty in securing arms. It has no difficulty in crossing and recrossing the Lebanese border with Israel or with Syria or with any other nation. It is frequently praised in the Beirut press for its sacrificial dedication to the common Arab cause. Its commandos are not seen as desperados, but as liberators. Premier Yafi of Lebanon has often and again visited the sabotage camps and inspected their activities. It's not unknown to him. And this group has openly admitted in the course of this last year alone responsibility for 70 acts of war against Israel. It was this front organization which pirated the El Al commercial aircraft to Algeria during the late summer, where Algeria interned the Israeli crew and the Israeli passengers for some 40 days. It was this group which claimed responsibility for the bombing in the Jerusalem marketplace last month, which claimed a dozen lives and seriously wounded 28. It was this group which sent two men to Athens 2 weeks ago with mortar and rifle and machine gun to destroy an El Al aircraft, and it was only a miracle which made it possible for the 100 people aboard to survive with only one loss of life. The Popular Front has operated openly in Lebanon. The Lebanese government knows of it, has cooperated with it, has inspected it. That is the innocence of the innocent, neutral nation of Lebanon, now so seriously aggrieved. What other recourse does Israel have? If the nations of the world had taken up their responsibility, if they were willing to impose or had been willing to impose military and economic sanctions on those nations which allowed the Palestine Liberation Front and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the Al-Fatah and all the other groups to exist on their soil and cooperate with their armies and indeed be staffed by their own army people, and armed by their own army arsenals, and trained by their own Soviet advisors. If the nations of the world had from the very beginning been willing to point the finger where the finger needs to be pointed, and to turn the screws on the nations on whom the screws need to be turned, we would never have come to this pass. But the nations of the world have chosen to have bifocal vision, magnifying vision against Israel and blurred vision against Egypt, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon. Israel cannot act. The other nations can do anything they wish. They can use the ceasefire as a cloak for any act of war, as long as they don't do it against American installations or British oil equipment or something of this kind. Israel has no alternative. And those who have rushed into print to condemn Israel for overreacting had better remember the old adage not to judge any nation or any people until you have placed yourself in the same condition. What would you do if Cleveland had been besieged the last 18 months, if every night there were marauders on the streets? Every time you went to a theater, you were afraid that a bomb might explode, as they have exploded. As every time you went to the Rapid or the bus station, you were afraid for your life, because bombs have been placed there and they have exploded there. If you could not leave your school child safely to the school bus in the morning, knowing he would come home in the evening, the buses have been bombed. If every night some of your friends who farmed in the surrounding counties were murdered in their sleep, how would you react? And how would you react if every attempt you had made to remonstrate with the world, to gain their support, to gain a shield and a cover against such activity had been met with silence? If every time you had come before the world body You had been told, your complaint we will not listen to, their complaint is just. How would you react? What would you do? You would do, I believe, just what Israel has done. Take responsibility for your own safety, and that of your family, and that of your neighbors. In March of 1968, Minister Tekoa, on behalf of the Israeli government, announced to the United Nations that Israel was willing and prepared to accept the Security Council decision of November 1967 as a package, as a basis for a peaceful negotiation. Now, this resolution, November 1967, is somewhat vague, but it says in effect, there shall be a withdrawal of troops from conquered territory, that there shall be an end to the state of belligerency, that there shall be guarantees of borders, that there shall be free passage through the Suez and through the Persian Gulf and the Straits of Tehran, that there shall be some resolution to the human problem involved in the Middle East, and that there shall be a peace treaty to bring all of these problems to their conclusion. Now, Israel accepted this package as the basic terms to be put on the table in direct negotiations with the Arab world. The Arab world has accepted only one element in this package, the withdrawal of Israel. And the Arab world and its active, most active partner, the Soviet Union, has now insisted, and has insisted right along, in fact, that the necessary prerequisite for peace in the Middle East must be the unilateral withdrawal of Israel. Withdrawal where? To what boundaries? But it is unilateral and a withdrawal. And the Arab states obviously have in mind their success of 1957. Then, too, you'll recall Israel had moved into the Sinai and Israel had taken positions on the banks of the Suez. And the nations of the world and the nations of the West said to Israel, withdraw and we'll guarantee you that there'll be somehow freedom of passage through the waterways, that there'll be some kind of peace, there'll be a UN presence. And Israel withdrew. And what kind of peace was there? And where were these nations when it came to making good on their promises? Israel, quite understandably, is not prepared to withdraw until that peace which she ultimately must have is secured. And this the Soviet Union is not prepared to do, and this the Arab states are not prepared to allow. But interestingly, having come to this pass, Israel prepared, as she has always been prepared, to meet, to negotiate any and all outstanding issues. Having come to that point, by some strange, peculiar world logic which applies only to the Jew is now held to be the dam that holds up the logjam of negotiation. Israel is willing to negotiate anything. But somehow the bleeding hearts in the embassies and the bureaucracies and the foreign ministries and the state departments of the world, bleeding hearts whose eyes have dollar signs in them, these bleeding hearts say to Israel, you must make the first compromise. You must make the first move. You must break the logjam. And they don't say to Israel, make the first move and we will guarantee borders. We will guarantee arms. We will guarantee you your security. Oh, no. You be Christian with a small c, and we'll be hard-headed. Because when they're not talking to us, they mean Jewish, with a capital J. And that's how all this will somehow work out. A new term is a need for a more even-handed policy vis-a-vis Israel. Now, it sounds proper and judicious and reasonable. But how, I wonder, is a policeman to be even-handed between the assailant and the woman he's trying to rape? The United States has sent into the Arab world 25 times the value of the arms that she has sent to Israel. It was American-made guns in Jordanian hands which shelled Nahariya in 1967. It was American-made guns in Iraqi hands which shelled the Baisan Valley in 1968. If even-handedness is a code word, and it is, for a policy which will deny the phantom jets to Israel, the only arms that the United States has talked about supplying Israel since the end of the war, and the supplying of new arms to the Arab states, that's not even-handedness. So giving in to the Arab demands of greater military might, and those demands have only one goal, the war of liquidation, as they call it, the war of liberation against Israel. You want to know what even-handedness means? Read the sad record of the Security Council in the last 18 months. The United States has been even-handed in the Security Council, just as the State Department would always wish it to be. Our statements have been judicious. We have condemned Arab countries when they've infiltrated Israel, and we have joined in the official condemnation of Israel when she has taken retaliation against the Arab states. But our words are quickly forgotten. Against the Arab states, they're only the words of one ambassador making a speech. And the Soviet Union has proclaimed a veto against any specific condemnation or rebuke of any Arab state. And so the record is unbalanced because of our even-handedness. And if one were to read only the official record of the United Nations, one would believe that every once in a while, militaristic Israel launches a sudden thunderbolt against the peaceful people of the Arab world. And that's exactly the picture which is painted in any number of tracts which are circulating in schools and in churches and elsewhere in our land with the seeming imprimatur of world opinion. This is the result of even-handedness. You can't be even-handed in a world in which Russia is pursuing her own ambitions. And make no mistake about it. Russia is not interested in Israel. Russia is not interested in justice in the Middle East. Russia is interested only in Russia. And Russian ambitions now coincide with those of the more belligerent Arab states. The policy of the United States, the official policy of the United States, has recognized the implausibility of even-handedness. In June of 1967, President Johnson listed 5 points as prerequisites as the basis of American foreign policy, and there were points which all men of goodwill could agree in. By and large, the official pronouncements of the United States government have continued in that line ever since. But recently, we have seen the little foxes of the State Department, now that this administration is losing its hold, come out of the wall and begin again to undermine the recognition by every administration in the last 20 years of the essential identity of interests between Israel and the United States. And so we have seen in the last 6 months bilateral conversation between Dean Rusk, members of the Soviet delegations, in which they have explored how far America could come towards the Soviet position. And when these have been leaked to the public press, they have been denied, but they have taken place. And so we have seen in the last 6 months the publication by the State Department of the United States of a brochure intended for high schools in the United States and other citizens, which purports to give the background of the Six-Day War, and it's the most interesting background you'll ever want to read. As we go back in history, we found some doubt, some question raised as to the legitimacy of the State of Israel. There is no specific indication that Israel is there because it was established by vote of the world bodies, the United Nations. The Arab aggression against Israel and against the Yishuv in 1947 is pictured as a civil war between Arab and Jew. The events of 1968 are traced to somewhat to Russia, somewhat to Syria, but most especially to Israeli belligerency. There is no record there of the battle plan which had been developed by General Nasser for the attack against Israel. There is no record here of the $2.5 billion worth of arms that have been shipped into Egypt and Syria, the United Arab Republic, by the Soviet Union. There is no quotation here of any of the belligerent statements of General Nasser. And so it goes. And so we have seen the last 6 weeks, and it has worried all of us, I know, a mounting program in the public press designed to convince the American people that somehow America has been too friendly to Israel and that it is important now to disengage America from that friendship. We heard these words again in the mouth of the envoy of Mr. Nixon, Mr. Scranton, when he went into Cairo and Amman. He came back talking of even-handedness. We've heard such words in Charles Yost's mouth, the man, the diplomat who was recently appointed to be the head of our United Nations delegation. Mr. Yost published a year ago in Foreign Affairs a rather interesting article explaining the origin of the Six-Day War. And his was his thesis that it was some Russian meddling and some Syrian desperation and mostly Israeli militancy and belligerency which precipitated the war. And General Nasser is hardly mentioned. And when he is mentioned, he is made to appear as an innocent victim of the forces of history. And no one yet knows the position that the new administration will take. These appointments may not presage, though they are cause to worry. They may not presage the administration's position. The administration certainly will have to reassert its control over some of the Near Eastern people in the State Department, for whom Israel represents an unfortunate subject of conversation whenever they're just settling down to tea with their Arab counterparts. But perhaps Mr. Nixon himself has expressed his own opinion. And if we can take campaign oratory and statements as the honest position of a man's view, and I certainly can take this statement as an excellent position of what ought to be the American view, then perhaps the United States is recognizing its continuing responsibilities and will exert itself, not to be even-handed in the sense of giving all that the Arabs want, but of being even-handed and seeing to it that Israel has security, that Israel can maintain itself in the face of these threats. And by opposing the activity of the Soviet Union, allow Israel to fight its own battle with the Arab states and not have to take on the red superpower. In April of 1968, Mr. Nixon wrote as follows. Confronted with a diplomatic and military policy of expansionism and adventurism on the part of the Soviets, the American response has been halting and lame and ineffectual. Indeed, there seems to be no American policy at all in a region of the world where a single chance spark could ignite a local conflict that could bring the great powers hurtling together in a major confrontation. What should American policy be in this area, now that we have paid so dearly for the absence of an effective past policy? First, the first urgency is for America not to allow the balance of power to shift in favor of the militant Arab states bent on a new war. To this end, the United States must see to it that Israel's military strength is never at a level vis-a-vis the Arab militants that will invite a war of revenge, consequences of which we could not possibly foresee and which at all costs we must avoid. Second, the United States must deal directly with the Soviets and impress upon them both the urgency of keeping their client states in check and the dangers inherent to the peace in any renewal of the kind of wholesale Soviet irresponsibility evident just before the recent conflict. Third, The United States must take the diplomatic lead in forging an acceptable settlement. Included in the terms of that settlement should be solid guarantees that the currently occupied territories will never again be used as bases for aggression or sanctuaries for terrorism, access for the ships of all nations through the reopened Suez Canal and the Straits of Tiran must be guaranteed. It should include recognition of Israel's sovereignty, its right to exist in peace, and an end to the state of belligerency. With regard to the occupied territories, it is not realistic to expect Israel to surrender these vital bargaining counters in the absence of a genuine peace and effective guarantee. However, it is also my view that for Israel to take formal and final possession of these occupied territories would now be a grave mistake. It is my belief from my own visits to Israel and my own talks with her leaders that the one thing that Israel values more highly than the peace she desperately seeks is her freedom and national independence. If the United States is to help secure this for the future, then we must strengthen our ties with America's friends in the Arab world. Now, this is a kind of even-handedness which I could accept. The channels of communication that have been broken down must be repaired, and the United States must reestablish its position as being able to communicate with all, Arab and Jew, all who are appalled at the prospect of wasting their precious resource on another war. To find a just peace in an area of the world that has known only armed truce and three major and bitter wars in a generation is not an easy task. But the United States is not without diplomatic and economic resources, and its private and public men are not without cogent ideas to get directly at the underlying problems of refugees and water. And I think that we cannot wait longer to make that effort. A new administration will soon come into power. Its policy is still cloaked in uncertainty. Mr. Nixon follows his campaign statements. He will reassert the policies of Mr. Johnson, Mr. Kennedy, Mr. Truman before him. We pray that he will. But in any case, Israel is different. Because ultimately, Israel's destiny, whatever the great powers do, rests with her. As long as she is willing to gamble her life, the initiative remains hers. And Israel is today understanding again why the editors of our Bible added a postscript to the book of Ecclesiastes, this pessimistic dismissal of hope. And that postscript reads, "The end of the matter, all having been said, fear the Lord and keep his commandments." And that is the whole man. There has never been in our long history any guarantee of survival. The dawn has never loomed that bright on the near horizon. But fearing the Lord, keeping his commandments, keeping our heads, keeping our strength and our will, we have survived. We will survive these dangers, those that as yet lie ahead and unknown. And what is true of Israel is true of us. American life has been good to us. Good beyond our fondest dreams. If there is now some danger implicit in our lives here, the answer is not to wring our hands and shed tears, but to continue in our way. Continue being self-respecting, not fearful. Fear the Lord, to keep his commandments, to be whole men.